Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. More than 5 million people in the United States have dementia. As 10,000 baby boomers turn 65 every day, that number is sure to rise. By the time a person reaches 85, the chances of them having dementia approaches 40%. But dementia is widely misunderstood. It's often confused with Alzheimer's disease, which is just one type of dementia, and we'll talk about this on today's show. The symptoms are not just memory loss. The last stages of dementia can be extremely difficult. Some people can't walk, swallow food, or even hold up their heads. In New York City, nearly one person with dementia gets lost every day. Today's guest, Dr. Tia Powell, says we are woefully unprepared to deal with this public health epidemic. She was unprepared to address the challenges she faced when her grandmother and then her mother were diagnosed with dementia. In her new book, Dementia Reimagined, Building a Life of Joy and Dignity from Beginning to End, Dr. Tia Powell says we need to focus more on providing care and not spend such a disproportionate amount of money on finding a cure. A cure is likely decades away, and people are suffering today. Dr. Tia Powell is director of the Center for Bioethics at the Montefiore Health Systems and Albert Einstein College of Medicine, where she is also professor of psychiatry and bioethics. Dr. Powell's scholarly interests are in dementia, public health disasters, social justice, and LGBT issues. And Dr. Powell joins us from New York City. Hi, Dr. Powell. Welcome to the show.
Hi, glad to be here.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for writing this book, especially your personal story. I just want to start off by saying this is going to be a hard show for me to host because for the last year I have been helping a loved one who has extreme depression, and I haven't gotten very far, and there were a lot of parallels in your book to what I'm dealing with personally and just how hard it is to, quote, find answers.
Yeah, it really is tough. Well, it is so lucky for the person that you're caring for that you're there for them. It's so much harder for them to do this on their own, but good for you for trying to be in there, and I agree, it's incredibly hard work.
Well, what was it like for you to write a book about dementia, but also include personal experiences, the experiences you had with your mom and the experiences your mom had with your grandmother?
I guess I felt going into it that I really I wanted to write a book that might be useful to people. And although, you know, as an academic, I love teaching, and I do hope that my work is useful, a lot of academic writing does not have a broad audience, and it doesn't deserve a broad audience because it's very dry and very technical. And I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to just write to the tiny circle of other academics interested in this issue. As you were saying, it's the kind of thing, there's so many families that are touched by dementia. Mm-hmm. It's so common, and people are really suffering, both the people with dementia and those who are trying to see them through. And I really, you know, this book is not going to make dementia easy, of course, but I did want to do something, however small, to try and help people with the struggle that they're having.
Well, it is very accessible, and as you say, this is a public health epidemic that we're woefully unprepared for. Up to 6 million people have dementia, and you write that one-third to 45% of us will have dementia by the time we are 85. And the baby boomers are getting older. 10,000 people turn 65 every day, so this is not going to stop. Why don't we start off by just talking in a very basic way. We did a show about Alzheimer's a couple of months ago, and there's a lot of new science out now about what we can do when we're younger to try to minimize or hopefully stop Alzheimer's from happening. So we went over what Alzheimer's is, and I'll ask you about the differences between Alzheimer's and dementia, but can you just give us a basic overview of what dementia is?
So dementia is an umbrella term, kind of like cancer, and there's lots of different types of dementia. Alzheimer's is generally thought of as the most common type, but there are lots of other types, and actually what's really most common is for a person to maybe have more than one type. So there's vascular dementia, where you have either very small, sometimes microscopic, or great big strokes, and the damage of that blood clot or bleed in your brain leads to dementia, so that's one type. Dementia can come as part of Parkinson's disease. There's a form of dementia called frontotemporal dementia, which often starts at a younger age. And then there are dementias associated with AIDS and various other kinds of things. So there's lots of different types of dementia, and each one might have a different kind of brain pathology that gets it going. Some are more connected to genetics, others less so. But they all have in common some basic symptoms in that it's a progressive illness. It's not, none of them are curable. They all take you from whatever level of kind of baseline cognitive skills you had, and it shows a steady decline that's not reversible, and it is a fatal illness. So that's a lot of bad news right there. These are really scary illnesses. Dementia really frightens people more, as I note in the book, more than any other disease, more than AIDS, more than cancer. People are really scared of dementia.
You also note, and I think this is really interesting to talk about, that the changes in your brain that lead to dementia begin at least a decade before you have the symptoms. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, and again, what changes in the brain are happening is a bit different from one type of dementia to another. But say with Alzheimer's, first of all, there's a huge debate about which brain's changes really best reflect the onset of dementia. So there's something that can happen in your brain with these goopy plaques called amyloid. And that has been treated as the most important brain change that indicates the onset of Alzheimer's disease. But here's the tricky thing with that. The majority of people with these amyloid plaques, and they do accumulate in lots of us as we get older, the majority of people who have them do not go on to get dementia. So this is a huge scientific controversy. What the heck do those things mean? There are other changes, too. You get these tangled proteins. They look like they're tied up in knots. That's called tau. And then there are other changes, too. Your blood vessels get leaky, you know, just as all of us kind of gets a little bit frailer sometimes as we get older. So, too, do the blood vessels in your brain. And there are additional changes. But all of that can get started way before you get symptoms, and particularly the amyloid. That may be there 20 years in advance, but it's also not clear that everybody with that amyloid, that's been the main thing scientists have been looking at, not everybody who gets that will get the symptoms of dementia.
What does the science tell us about what we can do to try to minimize or prevent this? Because when we did our show about Alzheimer's, a few doctors were on the show saying that diet is very related, exercise, having a sense of purpose, being outside as much as you can, being with loved ones, taking part in social activities. Would you say that those are similar to maybe when you're in your 30s, 40s, to try to do those things to prevent or stop dementia?
So there's no evidence that those things can stop dementia. We really don't have a cure. And if somebody tells you that they have a cure, you need to run the other way. There's a lot of scams and false information. On the other hand, so I'm leading with the negative there, on the other hand, doing some of the things that you've mentioned does help your overall health, including your brain health. So your brain, it's kind of like a game of Jenga, you know, where you pull out the little blocks and stuff. Mm-hmm. Everything that you do that puts pressure on your brain that's bad for it is going to make it easier for whatever genetic risk or whatever other problems you have to develop into dementia. So you don't want to do anything else that's sort of harmful for it. If you promote health overall, you're likely to be able, we see people are able to kind of slow down that onset of dementia. So it's by no means 100% guarantee. We don't think that this can actively prevent dementia, but we do think it can help maintain your brain health as long as possible. And exercise and fitness, as you said, there's really good data for that. It slows things down. Diet almost certainly makes a difference, although it's very hard to do diet studies because you've got to do them for years and years. And people cheat on their diets, and they tell you they ate broccoli, and they forget to tell you that they had 3 scotches with the broccoli. So, you know, it's really hard to do dietary studies. But we do think that basically more plants, more fruits and vegetables, less meat and less dairy, which to me is tragic because I love cheese. So you can, you know, you don't have to be completely pure. If you just do more of the good stuff and less of the bad, that does seem to make a real difference.
Hmm. You also write that early onset dementia comprises just 1% of the population. The overwhelming majority of people get dementia after the age of 65.
Yeah, that is true. And that early onset dementia, there's a much heavier genetic load there. So that's harder to do something about, unfortunately.
Can we also spend a little more time talking about the differences between Alzheimer's and dementia?
Yeah, so the difference between Alzheimer's and dementia, Alzheimer's is one type of dementia. So there are lots of different types of dementia, just as I was saying before, just like cancer. There's a million types of cancer, and so the way to cure cancer is not just one thing. You need a different approach to different types of cancer. And that's true for dementia, too. So what we may need to help us with Alzheimer's might not be what we need to help us with the dementia that comes with Parkinson's disease. So Alzheimer's is a common type of dementia. We certainly think of dementia as being primarily memory loss, but as you were saying in your introduction, that's by no means the whole story. And different types of dementia, and even different people with the same kind of dementia, may have more prominent symptoms of one kind or another. So some person might have dementia, and actually the memory isn't the biggest thing for them. It might be their executive function, the ability to plan things, you know, kind of underwear before pants, that kind of, you know, we take it for granted. It seems so silly. But if you don't have that skill anymore, you're in big trouble. So that kind of function could be a big deal in dementia.
In your research, you found that doctors are often misdiagnosing. So telling people they have Alzheimer's when they actually have dementia and then prescribing the wrong medications more than a quarter of the time.
Yeah, this is a big issue. Most people don't necessarily get their diagnosis from a specialist, but even with a specialist, a lot of people, when they see that picture that looks like dementia, they say it must be Alzheimer's. But there are relatively few people that have access to this sort of best, you know, testing, that kind of thing, and so they may miss a diagnosis of, say, frontotemporal dementia. That's one of the ones that we think was really underdiagnosed until relatively recent years, and probably still is being missed in a lot of cases. Most of the studies, of the few drugs that we have to treat dementia, they're just palliative medications. They don't in any way change the course of dementia. There are very few studies that look at those drugs in anything other than Alzheimer's disease. So if you have dementia with Parkinson's disease and there's no evidence that you have Alzheimer's, we don't have any data at all that says that those drugs that are tested in people with Alzheimer's, that they're going to be good for you. So that's very tricky. But again, the drugs are palliative in the sense that aspirin is palliative. If you have a fever, you know how you get that miserable feeling, you're achy, your head hurts, and the aspirin can help with those symptoms, and that's a great thing. You want to feel better. That's good. The aspirin will help you with that. If that's because you have a terrible pneumonia, that's where your fever is coming from, the aspirin doesn't do anything for your pneumonia. And that is the same thing that's true of the drugs that we have for dementia. They can help some people feel somewhat better for some time, but they don't change what's going on with your brain. And they don't have any impact on how long you're going to live and how serious that dementia is going to get before you pass away.
At what point should you seek professional help to find out if you possibly might have dementia? One of my colleagues at KALW said, my partner thinks she has dementia. And as you know, caregiving is so incredibly stressful. I mean, there were times when I forgot what freeway exit to take. I would lose my credit card and my phone, you know, leave it in a grocery cart. I mean, things I've never done before. And this came from the stress of caregiving. So stress causes brain fog. It causes you to forget things. At what point, I mean, I'm far away from 65, but at what point do you seek help and say, you know what, can I get tested, or I think I might have this? Can you talk about that?
Sure. Yeah, that's a great question. And it's been kind of controversial in medicine. For a long time, there were a lot of doctors, very well-intended and you know, well-informed, who didn't want to tell somebody when they thought that person had Alzheimer's disease or another type of dementia. They didn't want to say you have dementia because there was no cure. And they thought this would be so devastating, the person will be so upset, I just don't want to say that to them. I'll just say, oh, you're getting older. You might want to bring somebody with you when you go someplace new so you don't get lost, or, you know, try and be socially active and be fit and stuff. So that's a real problem for a variety of reasons. In my day job, I'm a bioethicist, and it makes me very uncomfortable when physicians intentionally don't tell the full truth to their patients. So we used to, decades ago, we used to do that with people with cancer. Oh, it's just going to upset her. Why should we tell her? Because it's her information. When somebody obtains information about you by examining your body, by looking at your blood test, by doing whatever they do, that's your information. Unless you say, I don't want to know, you know, tell my son, he'll be the decider. Unless you specifically say, don't tell me, that's your information. And really, your clinician has an obligation to share that with you, even if he can't cure it, and maybe especially when, so that you can do what you want to do, whatever you think is right. Maybe you want to say, huh, I'm going to think about my finances. I'm going to make sure that nobody can scam me. I'm going to make some protections. Maybe I want to talk about my family or think about, can I age in place in my housing? What's up in my community? Do they have good services? There are a lot of things that I personally, if somebody really said, I'm so sorry to tell you, you have dementia by these criteria, I'd have a lot of plans to make, and I would really want to know.
Hmm. Do you have any tips on how to navigate this system? Because, I keep bringing up my personal experience, but, you know, just in the last year, I've learned so much. It's one thing to read about it and talk to people, but when you're in the middle of it, as you know, it gives you a completely different perspective. And so you have one doctor actually prescribing an Alzheimer's medication, and you go to another doctor and they say, why did he give that to you? That's not going to help you. You should stop taking that. I mean, this has happened over and over again, and it is so incredibly frustrating. And I can't imagine, if you don't have a caregiver who has the time and the patience to deal with this, it's really difficult. So do you have any tips on how to navigate this very broken system that we have?
Oh, boy, I wish I could tell you how to make it easier. I agree with you. The system is broken. It's terrible, even for people who really do have their wits about them. But for people with an actual or potential cognitive impairment, it's brutal. So one of the things I would really love to see us change is really the culture of how we treat dementia. What happens now, our model today of best care, not terrible care. Unfortunately, you know, in any system you can get bad care. But our model for the best care in dementia today, I think, is wrong. So a colleague really sort of set off a light bulb in my head about a year or two ago. He called me up and said, I'm so upset. Can you help me? I took my sister, who's a fabulous professional, to a very fancy, mega, you know, academic medical center, and they concluded that she does indeed have dementia, and they said, that's it, you have dementia, I think Alzheimer's dementia in her case, and we can enroll you in a research trial with, you know, a new potential medication, and that was it. And when they left, she said, what, that does nothing for me? What, I mean, do I have to quit my job? What, you know, what do I do here? And that's not what they're set up to do. This is a great, esteemed physician who really knows his job, but our model of care is wrong. The standard of care should be, let's think about, we need to listen to you, we need to help, and we can tell you some of the things other people have told us. We can help you with some of the things that you may want to think about. Like you need to think about finances, you need an advisor, you need to protect what money you have and figure out what kinds of, you know, let's think about what your values and preferences are. Let's do that. Let's educate you about what you need in terms of medicine. But there's also a lot that you need that's not medicine. And that's the huge part. And we are not really doing enough, I argue, to connect people with guidance and services that are available in their community. And there are some good things there, you know, that you might want to have in place. So if you're at the beginning of dementia today, let's say the person has what we call minimal cognitive impairment. It doesn't quite meet criteria for dementia, but it sure looks like it's going there, and a lot of those people do go on to develop dementia. So suppose they catch a person at that level of minimal cognitive impairment. That's the perfect place to say, you're at risk. You're at risk in a number of different ways. let's pull a team together for you. Who's in your family? Who cares about you? Let's inform them. Let's hear from you. We want your voice here. We want your wishes. We want you to be the quarterback as long as you can. And let's figure out what's our plan. And we don't do that for people. So I think it really needs to change. I think there are some social workers. I think there are local communities where they have good advice. I think the local Alzheimer's Association Center may be able to provide some guidance. I think there are support groups for people who are at the start of having Alzheimer's, and there's certainly support groups for caregivers. And there's a lot of shared wisdom that people get in those groups. I think that's a great place to get tips about here's what you can do, here's what you should not do. But I agree, it's very tough.
Dr. Powell, I'm so glad that we're finally having a serious conversation about universal health care and Medicare for all in this country. But I feel that the conversation stops so short. Especially the presidential candidates, you know, they're not talking about the fact that we need so many more providers and that the system is broken. I mean, if you gave everyone health care tomorrow, the system would completely just snap. So what else do you think needs to be added to that conversation specifically around this issue?
Oh, so many things. How much time do you have?
Well, we have about 40 more minutes, luckily.
Oh, there you go.
So we have time.
Well, there are things, some things which may strike people as nerdy, but are really important. So bizarrely, we don't have anywhere near enough geriatricians. So, and we pay them terribly. So that's a good way to get fewer of them. It's actually really hard to fill a fellowship in geriatrics because it's one of the few specialties that you can go into where you'll actually earn less than if you didn't have the fellowship. So that's brilliant because our population is aging. Geriatricians are the specialists that take care of an aging population, and we need them. A lot of people over 65 are on 10, 12 medications. It's terrible for them. All the medications give each other, you know, they all have side effects. The side effects bump into each other. One of the main things that geriatricians do is try and keep you healthy and get you off some of those medicines. So that's really critical for dementia because with or without dementia, as you get older, your brain does age. And all of those medicines, often, they do not do you a favor in terms of clarity of thinking. There's so many, you know, just taking benzodiazepines, all those medications that people take so commonly to sleep, that's terrible for somebody with dementia. And even somebody with minimal cognitive impairment, that's going to push you right towards dementia. Terrible. So we need people with the expertise to say, let me think about you and your brain and what you're at risk for. And let's think about the risks and benefits of this medicine. Maybe we need to think about a different sleep regimen for you. You know, lots of people have trouble getting to sleep. It's a brutal, common problem. And the medicines that we have to treat it are terrible, in my view. They're very habit-forming, and they have a lot of side effects. I would start there.
Before we go to the next solution, and we're going to take a break in a minute, why are geriatricians paid so poorly?
They are reimbursed almost exclusively by Medicare. So here's an issue with the Medicare for All proposals. I am so in favor of getting health care for everybody. I'm more Medicare for more rather than Medicare for all because when you're on Medicare, sometimes you're not allowed to charge anything but Medicare. So if you can't charge more to patients who can pay more, you may not want to see older patients at all. You know, you may not want to have anybody in the Medicare age because it will be hard for you to pay the rent. So I think we need some more flexibility, a way to be able to charge more for people who can pay more so that people can still keep seeing people at the Medicare rates, which tend to be much lower. So that's kind of tricky, actually. You definitely want to increase the pool. We can argue that doctors make too much money, but they make different amounts depending on what they do. To take nothing from them, the cardiac surgeons make a whole lot of money. They do hard work. The geriatricians make not so much money. They also do hard work. So we've got so many different problems in the way medicine is set up in the U.S., and it's almost all of it is fee-for-service. So that's a whole other set of problems. So I don't want to bore you to tears with all of the health policy stuff, but we have a lot of work to do to clean up the mess that is American healthcare.
Yeah, no, that I think it's fascinating, and I'm sure our listeners do. We need to do a show about that. We're going to take a quick break. Today we're joined by Dr. Tia Powell talking about her very important book, Dementia Reimagined, Building a Life of Joy and Dignity from Beginning to End. Dr. Powell is director of the Center for Bioethics at the Montefiore Health Systems and Albert Einstein College of Medicine, where she is also professor of psychiatry and bioethics. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can send us an email, yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we're joined by Dr. Tia Powell talking about her very important book, Dementia Reimagined, Building a Life of Joy and Dignity from Beginning to End. Dr. Powell is director of the Center for Bioethics at the Montefiore Health Systems and Albert Einstein College of Medicine, where she is also professor of psychiatry and bioethics. I want to read a comment from Amy that she says, thank you so much. My dad has Alzheimer's dementia. He got lost in the car 55 miles from home before the police found him after 18 hours. He was hospitalized for 3 days after he was found and had zero recollection of his big adventure. Needless to say, they took his license away. Dad still insists he can drive and he's fine. He also got caught up in financial scams. It's really bad. She says, we need death with dignity for folks with late-stage Alzheimer's. It's not legal because the person with Alzheimer's isn't able at the late stage to take the night-night medicine. So folks with Alzheimer's are forced to live with the bitter end without compassionate end of life support. What are your thoughts on that, Dr. Powell?
Wow, that's a lot. I mean, it really sounds like she and her family have had such a hard time, and her dad, too. So I think we need to have a lot of different ways to help people with dementia and their families. There will always be people who feel that suicide is the only option for them, and that's a choice that we've never been able really to prevent. That will happen. I'm really hoping we have something in between what we have now and suicide. I'd really love to see for us to have good supports, great training, a better safety net for people with dementia and their families, so that you don't feel like suicide is the only option. I'd like to have people say, I have some other choices here. I don't know if you remember the movie Chicken Run. They're these chickens, they're trying to escape from their captors, and this one chicken, the lead chicken, makes a stirring speech saying, you know, it's time for us to get out of here. We're going to get out of here. We'll live a life of misery or we'll die trying. And one of the stupid chickens says, are those the only choices? So I'd really like for us to have some better choices than a life of misery or suicide. So going back to the driving, all that kind of stuff, I think being able to make it less humiliating and more normal to stop driving would be hugely helpful to people as they get older, to people with dementia. It's really tough in a lot of parts of the country where we don't have good public transportation, but I think that's a huge policy issue. We need to have all kinds of rideshare. We need to have, I mean, I hope one day we'll have self-driving cars. That would help. But this is a huge issue. There are people that hurt themselves, hurt other people, because they are not any longer capable of driving, and it's a terrible thing. We're so wrapped up in our notion of independence being connected to driving, it's really painful. I mean, and even Queen Elizabeth's husband, Prince Philip, had to have his license wrestled away with him. So this happens in all kinds of families all over the world. This is a big deal. So I'd like to see us work on that. What else? The financial scams, also a terrible, terrible issue. This happens really commonly. It's something like a $3 billion industry. Very easy to take money from somebody with a cognitive impairment. I mean, particularly just knowing that somebody has a landline makes it more likely that they're an older person. Young people don't have landlines anymore. So you've called up just different people with a landline and say, oh, I'm from, you know, the computer company, and I understand, I can tell from my data that you're having trouble with your commuter. You will actually get people to go, oh, that's so great. I was having trouble with my computer. And all they do is say, well, give me your bank account number, and I can get this all fixed up for you right now. And it's just that simple.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to really figure out how can we, without humiliating people, without making them feel that they're made into babies, how can we provide protections? How can we keep people from scamming those who are developing cognitive impairments? How can they feel safe? And really, what do we need to do to get right the balance between freedom and safety here? Mm-hmm. And, you know, in terms of suicide, I frankly don't think that aid in dying is going to be a possibility any near time for those with dementia. All of the states in the U.S. that have passed legislation to support aid in dying set it up to exclude people with dementia, and it's done on purpose. They all say you have to die within 6 months and you have to have full decision-making capacity. So that can never happen with dementia. Mm. And that's partly to protect people with other disabilities. Nobody feels comfortable in this country, for the most part, pushing euthanasia on somebody just because they're disabled. We want the person themselves to say, no, I'm making this choice and I don't want to do it. So it really has excluded those with dementia, and I think advocates of aid in dying are unlikely to change that, because that's been an important part of the recipe for success. So I don't think we're going to have that. We need to figure out what protections, what care needs to be in place for people who are living with dementia.
Well, thank you for the comments, Amy. Today we are speaking with Dr. Tia Pell about her new book, Dementia Reimagined, Building a Life of Joy and Dignity from Beginning to End. Up to 6 million people in the United States have dementia, and 10,000 baby boomers are turning 65 every day. So that number is set to rise. By the time someone reaches 85, the chances of them having dementia approach 40%. And Dr. Pell says we really need to start focusing on care, because at this point we are so unprepared for this public health epidemic. Let's go to our next caller, Mark in San Francisco. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Hello. I'm just wondering why you're not talking about the Buck Institute study, anti-aging, where they've actually reversed Alzheimer's. They've had people as low as 12%. And that protocol has actually been published as a book, The End of Alzheimer's. And I live in San Francisco, and I had a traumatic brain injury from a bike accident. And I brought myself back. I had literally a instant recall before that, and then I had to bring. And the simple thing is, a third of the Buck protocol is cut out the bad stuff. A third of it is add in good fruits and vegetables and healthy things. And a third of it is exercise. So I'll take my answer off the air, but why are you not talking about that?
Thank you. I believe you're referring to the book, The Alzheimer's Solution.
The End of Alzheimer's.
Oh, The End of Alzheimer's. Okay.
It's a different book.
We did touch on this earlier, but do you want to elaborate a bit, Dr. Pell?
I do. So I couldn't hear everything the caller was saying, but I will comment on that book and other similar ones. I am not persuaded by that book. There are no studies in there that are clinical trials that are of the kind that provide to physicians convincing information that suggests that you've proven that this thing can work. There are anecdotes in there saying, I tried this, here's one person. There are very small studies. They are not published in what I would call frontline journals. So I come, regrettably, to the conclusion that that is not a regime that I would recommend to anyone, and that I really am very uncomfortable with that book, I have to say.
And can you repeat the name of that book?
The book is called The End of Alzheimer's.
Okay.
And I believe that's the one that the gentleman was talking to. There are a number of books that purport to have a cure. As we were saying earlier, there are certainly some things that you can do that are good for your brain health, like exercise and maintaining a good healthy diet, more fruits and vegetables. People also find some suggestion that being intellectually active, socially active, all of that can be helpful for you. And getting hearing aids, actually having your hearing tested and making sure that it's as good as can be, that actually can help people maintain social connection. So there are definitely some things you can do to strengthen your cognition, but none of those constitute a prevention of dementia, including Alzheimer's dementia. There are also a lot of other people that are promoting supplements and things like that. It's important to know that the FDA recently sent letters to a dozen or so supplement manufacturers saying, you cannot make the claims you're making that you cure or prevent Alzheimer's and other dementias. You don't have data. If you make that claim, we're going to regulate you like a drug, and you're going to need the kind of data that a drug needs to have. So you got to stop it. You are not telling the truth.
Well, thank you for the call, Mark. Let's go next to Elizabeth in Berkeley. Hi, Elizabeth. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you so much for doing this. Both my parents had dementia and Alzheimer's sequentially. I'm very concerned about myself. I have one of the genes, and I just going through it with them, even though they were in a full care facility,
wow,
it makes me very anxious, because I have to say this was an upscale full care facility, and this facility, which was new, was not prepared. They even said they were not prepared for the tsunami of people with Alzheimer's, and I didn't feel that the care my father got, who was the only one who progressed to a state of not being able to take care of himself, thankfully my mother died before that, when someone reported that he was being abused, she was fired for reporting it, because went to us instead of to them. The geriatric doctor was prescribing my mother Ambien. I had to fight for years to get that doctor to not prescribe Ambien to my mother. This is in New York, in an upscale area, so I can only imagine what the healthcare situation is for others and myself. Well, I can't afford what they can, because the other problem we had was finding aides who are sufficiently trained to take care of people with Alzheimer's. There was very few people who were actually sufficiently trained. And you have to pay for it yourself unless you have long care insurance. So I just think that I think actually my mother asked me if I would help her if she ever got very debilitated to die. And in New York I could not. Anywhere I cannot. But I think it's a mistake for us to think that you can provide a real quality of life, even given what we have, but even so, because when my father progressed to the state where he could not, I mean, they were putting him on antipsychotics. This is very common. And this is, again, a very upscale place.
Wow.
Because many people with dementia start to act out, and the only treatment they have is to give them antipsychotics or other medication.
Not true, though. There are other ways of dealing with acting out and behavioral symptoms and that kind of thing.
The only way that is utilized in the facility, he was put in a psychiatric place. When he came back to the full care facility, this is what he's prescribed. And this is a place that is very upscale, a Quaker facility. So there may be other treatments, but that requires so much staffing and so much experience that most places do not have that. I don't know any place that has that. Do you?
I do know some, yeah. I can't really make recommendations of specific places over the phone, but gosh, you've said so much. I mean, and it really sounds like you guys have had such a tough experience, even as you say, you worry that you guys are at the upper end of the spectrum, that this is, you know, you've had probably a better experience than other people might have done, but it's still so hard. I do think we need to do a lot more to train caregivers. We need to respect how difficult it is to be a caregiver for somebody with dementia, whether you're a family member or a paid carer. That's a really tough job, and there are things that you can know that will help. One of the common issues with dementia is that sometimes people, as their dementia progresses, don't like to bathe. So they get very agitated, they don't want to bathe, and if you combine that with incontinence, which is also common in dementia as it advances, that's a huge problem. And so that used to be a reason why, well, forget it, you can't stay in your home anymore. It's too hard for us. We can't do it. And even nursing homes sometimes would really have a tough time with somebody like that. But there are, you can do really good training to help bathing be less frightening for somebody with dementia. And there's some lovely programs that have really looked at what works and how we can do that and how we can get it forward. And there are also much better ways to deal with incontinence than we used to think of before. We also need, like, better products, better diapers, easier to use, less embarrassing, that don't look like baby diapers. We need, it's not a moral failing. It's just a, it's a breakdown of the system. It's an engineering problem. And we need to put our best minds to working at, okay, that's the issue for somebody. Agitation, that's the issue. Not wanting to take a bath, that's the issue. Incontinence, what are the ways we can attack that? What are the ways we can, you know, really address that challenge? So more training for carers, more good thinking about how you can intervene. What can you do besides antipsychotics? And by the way, nursing homes that use antipsychotics are getting dinged by the federal government when they do their inspections. That is a way. The percentage of people that you have on antipsychotic medications is part of how you get ranked. And the higher the number of people on antipsychotics, the lower your ranking as a nursing home. So the federal government is trying here to improve our standards for dementia care, but it's really tough. But there are behavioral interventions, there are distractions, there are all kinds of, they use sometimes even fake pets and things like that, that kind of calm people, and that can be surprisingly effective in terms of calming agitated people, and it's way safer than using antipsychotics that can make you delirious, make you fall, make you get a broken hip, all kinds of problems with those.
Wow. Well, thank you so much, Elizabeth, for calling in and sharing your story. Let's go next to Marie in Hayward. Hi, Marie. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for the program. I've always been curious to, and I wonder, is there anything that can help if a person has some cognitive ability? For instance, you know, they might not be able to express themselves all the time, but once in a while they'll have a flash of understanding. Is there any way that that can be encouraged in people that are, and I don't know what point that might be in dementia, but how might that be encouraged and perhaps built upon?
Well, I'm not sure I follow. You're talking about how can we encourage people to sort of feel happier and feel better? Is that what you're asking?
No, when they come into, sometimes people have a period of understanding.
Yeah.
A real understanding, and then they might go out of it again.
Right.
And is there something that can help that, encourage it more so?
Well, there's certainly no guaranteed ways. This is the main, you know, one of the main symptoms of dementia is that you are less sharp cognitively. So if we could fix that, we would be, you know, pretty close to all the way home. But there are some things you can do. One of the issues that a lot of people have worked on is well-being in dementia. It's not the same as being cognitively sharp, but what experiences can we give people that will make them feel content and less agitated? And this can be an incredibly important way of combating agitation and aggressive behavior. So some facilities use music a lot. They have playlists where they do kind of a guesstimate, and then they play songs and see how an individual person responds. Music for all of us is an incredible pathway to joy. You know, when you hear the song that you really love, it actually can really help with mood, and it's a lot safer than an antipsychotic. So using music to sort of improve mood, to calm people, and even sometimes when the person doesn't remember what that happy experience was, it can sort of stay with you. That happy feeling can kind of linger on sometimes, just as it does for the rest of us. So even if you don't remember what caused it, you may still feel good. And similarly, when people are cruel to you, when you've been treated in a disrespectful way, when somebody's told you, you know, you're stupid, you already told me that 3 times, your feelings are hurt and you can feel bad. And it will, that bad feeling will stick with you even if you don't remember why. And I think sometimes it's those bad feelings, actually, that make it less likely that somebody's going to have one of their good moments and really perk up and be bright and, you know, show you that they remember who you are and all of that kind of stuff. So I think, you know, joy is important in every life, including for somebody who's disabled and has a cognitive impairment. So figuring out how to increase well-being and see what we do. And I'm not a ninny. I'm a physician. I'm a psychiatrist. I know how hard dementia is, but I really am serious about this. I actually think we haven't done enough work yet to think about what would it look like to actually have some happiness within the context of dementia, and can we get more of that for people with dementia? And I think that that would also bring more happiness to people who take care of those with dementia. So that's sort of, that's a key struggle for me. I'd love to see us do more of that.
Thank you for calling in, Marie. We have time for just a few more callers. Let's go to William in Belvedere. Hi, William.
Yes, thank you. Although I'm glad you're discussing this topic, I'm sorry to say that I feel the guest has a certain ivory medical tower quality about the things she's discussing. Let me give two examples. She says if your memory isn't so good, you're getting older, go to see the doctor to see what's wrong. Well, see if you have dementia. Well, that's interesting, except assuming that you have mild memory loss, and it doesn't interfere with your driving, and God forbid there's an accident, the question is whose fault it was, and the lawyers get started. Have you seen a doctor about anything lately? Well, yes, I went to see the doctor because my memory wasn't, I was concerned about my memory. End of story. That's a practical thing that happens because of our total system. So I would like to say, find out how she feels that could be avoided. The second is, although she's talking about...
Wait, can you pause there? What is it that you're hoping to get avoided? Do you not want the person to get in trouble because of the accident because they have dementia? What is it that you're hoping to deal with there? Let's talk about that one.
I'm going to answer your question. As soon as you go to see a doctor, and the attorney asks, well, what did you see the doctor about? Well, my memory wasn't so good. That, in a legal case, that's the end of the story. You'll never get insurance, you'll be wiped out, etc. That's a practical aspect of our society. So, but you do have to answer those questions, and if you went to see the doctor, of course, you said your memory wasn't so good, but the other driver never saw the doctor, because they didn't have any question about their memory. You decide what the outcome is going to be. I know what the outcome would be. The other thing is, you speak very calmly, well, we'll do this, and we'll take care of the people, and we'll play music for them, and we'll stimulate them. Could you tell me how the family avoids being completely wiped out financially by providing this care?
Okay, those are two big questions. Let me see what I can do. The one in terms of driving, medical information is, of course, confidential. Let me back up on that. People who have dementia, people who meet that criteria, have a higher likelihood of getting in car accidents when they drive than people who don't. So, you know, there are some states where actually your doctor is supposed to tell the Department of Motor Vehicles when they make a diagnosis of dementia. If you are a risk to the public health, I'm not sure that it's so bad if you can't get insurance. I'm not sure you should be driving if you have dementia. So the idea that it's so terrible that you've been to see a doctor and they told you you had dementia, you then continued to drive and you got in an accident, I'm not sure I really want you to be driving if you have dementia. I'd certainly like us to do more to support people so they don't feel that they have to drive to get around. And in rural areas, that's a huge issue. It's one thing to say you're not a safe driver. That doesn't tell us how you're going to see your family, get to the grocery store, do the things you need to do. So we really need to think about how can we help people, just as we get older, leave out dementia. How can we help more people get around easily? And I'll leave aside the court issues for, you know, another day. Maybe the other driver was bad. Who knows? I don't. The other issue is about finances. This is a big, big issue. Our policies do not sufficiently protect us in terms of paying for good dementia care. What a lot of legal advice is these days is, you know, if you need to be in a nursing home, you should spend down, get rid of all your assets. That's the most common, that is very common legal advice. It's really problematic. A lot of states see the portion of their budget that goes to Medicaid bills is very high, and the biggest chunk of Medicaid in some states is nursing home costs. So many states are moving to decrease nursing home beds and to make it very difficult to get into a nursing home bed, which Medicaid pays for. So here's a crucial point. Medicare, the public financing system that pays for care for older people, does not cover long-term nursing home costs. That is only covered by Medicaid, the program that pays for the poor. So if you need long-term nursing home care because of dementia or another reason, you need to be covered either by private insurance out of your own pocket, and it is very expensive, or you need to be on Medicaid, the program for the poor, and you do that by getting rid of all your assets. This is a big problem. We're not going to be able to pay for every, if we're driving the middle class onto Medicaid, a program designed for the poor, and we already think we're paying too much for that, we're really digging a big hole here. So we have a lot of work to do to figure out, is long-term care insurance appropriate? How can more people get it? It's quite expensive. It's, by the way, much more expensive for women. We are more likely to get dementia because we live longer, and we are less likely to be able to have resources to pay for our own care. And we are more likely to provide dementia care for other people. So the reward for taking care of other people is that we actually will pay much more if we want to get long-term care insurance. That's a perfectly legal and, I think, perfectly shameful way that we have structured paying for dementia care in America today.
So, well, we are definitely going to do a show about long-term care and finances, because that is just a major crisis in this country. Thank you for the call, William. Dr. Tia Powell is author of Dementia Reimagined, Building a Life of Joy and Dignity from Beginning to End. She's director of the Center for Bioethics at the Montefiore Health Systems and Albert Einstein College of Medicine. Dr. Powell, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And thanks to Kevin Vance for answering the phones today. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.